Matt, what's that? Isn't it?
Oh my gosh, it's us.
It's us at the end of the podcast.
And we're just about to pick...
Oh no, we can stop this fate, surely.
Oh no.
Time's catching up with us. Hello.
Hello.
Mimicking there, very funny. Welcome to... Episode 14 of Season to Taste. Actually, we've got no reason to be all slow and glum because the story we've just watched was really good. And that was, as listeners of Episode 13 of Season to Taste will know, the Space Museum. Specifically, of course, the episode to the Space Museum, The Dimensions of Time, The Search and The Final Phase, because they all have different names, like in the olden Hartnell days.
Yes.
So did you like it as much as I did, Matthew?
I thought it was very good, yeah. Given that I have heard only bad things about this story, really, I was surprisingly entertained by it.
Because in the last episode, you were a bit reluctant to go for it. I think you were given what received wisdom is.
Yes.
And yeah, I hadn't seen it before, and was really pleasantly surprised. It's like a new episode of Doctor Who, a new story, you know, discovering a new episode of Doctor Who.
Very funny, isn't it? It was very and deliberately funny, not just, oh, this is awful, but let's laugh at it. It's genuinely quite funny.
It is, and it's very much one of those, it's, in the same ways you have Shakespeare comedies, you have Hartnell comedies and Hartnell historicals, and and it's very much one of the Hartnell comedies. You know, there's a happy ending, well, they all have happy endings, but it's actually funny as well. You know, you've got the Doctor having really fun, you know, it's a 60s Doctor Who story, and so it is a bit slow, but and scenes are drawn out. But most of episode 2 is a scene with the Doctor and the Governor, Los Lobos, and it's just really fun with the Governor kind of trying to read the Doctor's mind, and the Doctor putting pictures of walruses and penny farthings on the screen, and generally kind of running rings around him.
Is the Hartnell tragedy when he gets a cardiovascular degenerative disease and ends up losing his career and his mind?
Yes. No, I was thinking of the Daleks' Master Plan because two of the companions died. But I mean, we could go with yours.
Okay. The other thing I like about that sequence, because I think that scene in episode 2 in The Dimensions of Time, where Hartnell's strapped in the chair.
I was trying to remember which episode it was, and it's very easy because Hartnell isn't in episode 3.
No, he's not. It's one of his weeks off, isn't it? But when he's strapped in the chair in The Dimensions of Time and he's projecting his mental images on the screen, he's brilliantly good in that. He's got his kind of sarcastic little mocking laugh and he's really trying to wind Governor Lobos up. And he projects an image of himself in a bathing costume, which is something no one wanted to see. And yet there it is, preserved when the Abbot of Amboise will never be seen again.
You reminded me, speaking of kind of mocking sarcasm, you reminded me of the bit where the Doctor does a very doctorish explanation for something in one of the episodes, and Ian just goes, well, thank you for that.
That's at the end, isn't it? Where he brings out a piece of spring or something like that and says, oh, this was it. Have you ever turned on a light switch and it hasn't come on straight away? And Barbara says, yes, I think everyone's had that experience at some point.
Well, it was like that, except what it did was completely screw up all of time travel.
But the TARDIS, you just think the Hartnell era is full of stories about broken springs, because The Edge of Destruction's about a spring that gets stuck, isn't it?
The button gets stuck down.
Yeah, the button gets stuck down, so the spring doesn't work properly.
Since he left Gallifrey, the cleaner hasn't been able to come in and dust his buttons. There's all that gunk. On the keyboard where you get gunk under the keys, that's clearly happened on the console.
It's all that pineapple that he likes to eat, spitting it all over the console.
That was Richard Handel.
It's the same one.
That's the tragedy.
Counts.
That's the tragedy of William Hartnell. It's Richard Handel. But it's a really fun story, and obviously, and it's strange because it's got that kind of mind robber thing in episode 1, where the crew are disconnected from the story and wandering around and leading in, and it's got on the one hand a really interesting idea, which is, use episode 1 to basically see what the end is going to be. The Doctor and his companions find themselves in the museum, and they find themselves as exhibits, and spend the rest of the story trying to stop that happening. And it gives it a really good forward momentum. And all the way through, they're really not sure. And it's got lovely ideas about, you know, fate and the whole Inferno thing about free will. And each time they make a decision, they have no idea whether it's a decision that helps save them from that fate or it help or pushes them towards it. That's really interesting. And it's a lovely setup. And it's a really, you know, it's a shock when you see them. I was joking to you, having... because I've never seen the story and I've never read the story, I was joking as we watched it that if I said, you know, oh, they're in a space museum, if this was a modern Doctor Who story, the Doctor would just be in there. And then that's exactly what happened. They came up with that idea in the 60s. And the TARDIS is there, and these really quite impressive hologram type effects where all, you know, all it is a little semi-transparent overlay.
Yeah.
But it looks as good as kind of one of those bits in Quantum Leap where hologram Al walks through things.
Yeah, I mean... it helps tell the story. It's not the most impressive effect in the world, but neither is it bad enough that you're sitting there going, well, that's just terrible. I mean, the title's a bit too see-through the end of episode one.
But you see exactly what it's supposed to be straight away.
You understand it. But what I think is great about the first episode is they don't milk the mystery for too long. They realise at the point when the audience realise, or the smarter members of the audience have realised that they're invisible and they can't interact with the environment. They don't kind of work it out right at the end of the episode when everyone else has worked it out half an hour before.
It plays with the tropes of the show, which may not even have been tropes of the show then, really well. Because I was getting annoyed that they kept hiding in plain view. And it turns out they could hide in plain view because nobody could see them.
Yeah.
And so what we thought was something that was just a bit rubbish, why don't people hear them? Why don't people see them? Actually, because they couldn't see them.
And I think that kind of the end of the first episode... And indeed, there's a few moments in the first episode where you get that kind of pang of existential angst where the Doctor kind of ponders maybe they don't exist at all, and then obviously they see themselves in the future and they've become mummified exhibits in a museum. It does have that kind of slightly sinister edge to it. I do think the first episode is the kind of thing, if it was made in the new series, it would just be the pre-title sequence and they'd get it over and done within 4 or 5 minutes. But I think that's true of probably 80 or 90% of all first episodes of Doctor Who.
They have a lot of very overwritten conversations. Like after Vicky drops the glass in the TARDIS and it miraculously mends itself, we see it happen, then she tells the Doctor about it, then she insists to Barbara that it's happened and explains that it's all happened again. And frankly, her doing it was enough. We didn't need... to go over it several times. I mean, the downside of this plot is it doesn't really make any sense. The idea that they're walking on dust but not making footprints, well, you just... if you're not there, you're not there. But actually, even if you accept that, and their clothes mysteriously changing, which is brilliant because it comes across at the beginning like the Doctor has rohypnaled the rest of the TARDIS crew.
And he seems incredibly blasé about the whole thing.
Yeah, he seems to think nothing abnormal's happened.
Well, that's very convenient or something.
Yeah, so they're all saying, our clothes have gone back to normal from our crusade outfits. And he's going, oh, no, it just happened, it's fine. And they're like, did you take all our clothes off, Doctor, while we were unconscious? And then do something and then put our new clothes.
quite so.
Anyway... but that kind of, you realise that they've done this kind of jumping a time track thing, and there's a lot of nonsense chat about dimensions of time, which is irrelevant, really.
It's almost like they haven't got the language to be able to explain that kind of story in the 60s.
So it's that thing where I think I might have said this when Time Team did Rise of the Cybermen and the Age of Steel.
Oh, okay.
Rose and Mickey go to the parallel world, and they just go, oh, it's a parallel universe, like in films.
Yeah.
Whereas in Inferno, you had to have a big, long discussion about...
because it wasn't as familiar. And it's like in 1965, when this story was broadcast, the idea of jumping a time track and actually having... they're basically ghosts from their own future, aren't they?
Yeah.
I think the idea is supposed to be that the TARDIS is materialised, but not materialised properly. And they're walking around, but the effect of... them walking around isn't happening at the same time as the cause.
You can't really get the logic through because they haven't done it quite right. They've come up with a really interesting idea and it doesn't quite work. I mean, the glass smashing and reforming doesn't fit at all.
You can do the price of bread.
No, it hasn't. It's another weird thing that shows something timey-wimey is happening, but it's not really clear. And you do have to kind of suspend your disbelief, ignore how they're trying to explain it, and just go for they've managed to see themselves in the future and now they have to not have it happen.
Wibbly wobbly timey wimey. Words I will never say again.
I will hold you to that.
The other thing I really loved about the first episode was when they go around the corner and they suddenly see a Dalek in front of them. And there's a kind of shock reveal. Oh, it's a Dalek. Is this going to be a Dalek story? Oh, no, it's an exhibit in the museum.
Yeah.
I thought that was really neat. And I thought it was then neat
It's like the cyberhead in Dalek.
It is. But then Vicky's kind of very blasé about them because they're just a thing from history.
Yeah.
It's like a kid nowadays, I guess, seeing Nazis in a museum.
Or the French.
Film. Yeah, or the French. It doesn't really mean that much to them other than a bogeyman from history.
And really nicely paid off at the end when the Daleks turn up and the Doctor gets the time-space visualiser and the Daleks are watching, are following the TARDIS in a time machine, which at the time, when you've only had two Dalek stories before, neither of which the Daleks can time travel in, to suddenly have these, the most famous villains in Doctor Who actually chasing the Doctor through time as your cliffhanger is a brilliant cliffhanger to go out on, and nice to kind of seed it with a little discussion of the Dalek at the beginning of the story, and having the genuinely really funny bit where Hartnell's just hiding in it.
And he's delighted that he's hiding in it as well, and doing the little voice and making the plunger
wiggling the plunger. One of the signs of a good Doctor Who story, I think, is good supporting characters. And amongst what could be really boring, generic authority figures and rebels.
Yeah.
And it's the first, when we were saying we were watching it, it's probably the first. It becomes a bit of a recurring theme in 62. People in control and the rebels, like in the Crotons and
the Dominators
and maybe the Savages as well. But actually, this is kind of the first time that it's done.
Mm.
That you have, not quite like the coexisting races, like the Daleks and Thals, but where some people in authority wear their big shoulder pads and other people are trying to overthrow them. And they could be really bland, but actually they're not. Lobos is a good character, and he has a character the moment you see him. He makes an impression.
A weary governor who doesn't really want to be stuck in this backwater planet, a declining empire.
A lot of army people who don't really want to work for him.
Very insubordinate. Bitch about him behind his back, but to his face there. The army commander is very wearily respectful to his face, but as the minute his back's turned, he's slagging him off to all the troops.
It's odd. It's like the last two stories that we watched. He's a bit like Colin Jeebus in The Underwater Menace, doing that kind of bored, we'll sort this out attitude. But the officers are quite like the crew in Warrior's Gate and how they behave to the captain in that. That kind of he has the costume of an authority figure, but he doesn't have the authority.
It's very kind of 1980s in Doctor Who. I mean, you do get it occasionally in stories all the way through, but it's much more familiar in the 1980s to have an insubordinate, on the verge of insurrection crew complaining about they've got no money and they're complaining about...
It's that lovely touch of realism where the commander moans about his rank and his pay.
Yeah.
People do get paid, don't they, in these sci-fi armies.
You can imagine an Eric Saywood story, like Resurrection of the Daleks, Rula Lenska complaining about how nothing works and how it's rubbish and how the captain's crap or whatever, but it's not something you necessarily associate with William Hartnell or Doctor Who.
Yes.
So it's quite interesting to see it happening so early.
And as well as those Moroks, you have the Zeroms. Jeremy Bullock, I think, is what are you giggling at?
I'm just remembering their eyebrows.
The two levels of... Oh, there's this wonderful moment where Vicky says something like, you're more of the Moroks or something, and they go, no, we're completely different.
And you know that line's written, because the whole thing's a comedy. You know that the writer's thinking, these are going to look almost exactly the same, because they can't really afford to do anything
different. They're just more men with slightly different facial hair.
Obviously, the Zerons think the Moroks, with their bizarre kind of badger hairstyles, look totally different to everyone from the outside.
Yeah, and Vicky's got the slightly embarrassed, they all look the same to me, racism.
Although she does have a bit of a romance, doesn't she, with Tor,
Jeremy Bullock.
Yeah.
Who's great, and he's another person who kind of turns up and immediately, it's just the way he speaks and his actual voice as well, make him really recognisable. You can have a problem where you've got a load of people from some alien race turn up.
Yeah.
you know, it takes you a while to tell them all apart and work out quite what their roles are. And he very much turns up and is clearly the leader and clearly identifiable. And it comes across as quite a good actor, which is always a help. And one of the others one of the others is plays Darko, is Peter Kraze, who's Michael Kraze's
brother. Michael Kraze's uglier brother.
Aww. The most important thing about the Xerons is, or certainly Tor, I think, has basically my trainers.
It does wear Converse trainers, which is quite amusing. They're kind of slightly rubbish rebels, but Vicky's amazing, isn't she?
She basically incites
a planet-wide rebellion, overthrows the Moroks.
She reprograms the computer so that it doesn't need the answers it expects. It just needs to know the person is telling the truth and says, "Why do you want the guns?" And she says, "Revolution!" it's like Che Guevara.
It's like Doctor Who's clearly now sided with youthful rebellion over...
Doctor Who is going to cause 1968, isn't he?
Yeah. So, you know, for all that Patrick Troughton's the anarchic spirit of the late 60s Doctor, Vicky's definitely got there first. She's definitely a right-goer for a bit of armed insurrection and rebellion, isn't she? She's a really good character, actually. It's a real shame that Maureen O'Brien didn't get to do a bit more. It's a bit of a shame as well that she's slightly disowned Doctor Who. I mean, I know she's done a couple of Companion Chronicles, but she's so good. And Vicky's actually a really good character.
Mm. And the story she leaves in The Mythmakers features the guy who plays the Mork Commander, Odysseus.
Oh, okay.
Actor fact.
He's also in one of my favourite films, House of Whipcord.
And also Black Orchid, I think.
Well, moving swiftly on.
Before we start talking about the Moroks and the Xerons, the other thing about the Moroks is they're basically... Well, Dean McCoy has been reading too much H.G. Wells, hasn't he? And so he's read The Time Machine and he's gone, "I'm going to do a story that has some time travel stuff in it and is a bit timey-wimey, and I'm going to use Moroks." Mm. And the idea of the two races in The Time Machine is basically lifted from that, isn't it? and then having said there's an actor fact, he, of course, turns up in the Sontaran experiment.
Yes.
As an actor.
By all accounts, this was one of the happiest teams of regulars, given that we know Hartnell became a bit of a horror story in the next couple of years. He really enjoyed working with Jacqueline Hill and William Russell, and he really enjoyed working with Maureen O'Brien, and she kind of toned him down a bit and helped to smooth his rough edges and acted as a bit of intermediary behind the scenes as well. I think that does come across on screen. They come across in their scenes together, and they get a lot of scenes together in the first couple of episodes as really enjoying each other's company, really bouncing off each other. You really get the sense that they're a team who work well in each other's company. And I think it's great when Barbara and Ian have a little argument about Ian's getting irritable or something like that. And they come across as a real couple.
I'm not irritable.
It's exactly the kind of argument that a couple would have.
Yes.
The other bit that I love about it is when Ian has the idea of copying Theseus and the Minotaur, as he calls it.
He says, "Oh, we'll do like the Minotaur." Like, "Oh, you've been on a Minotaur as well, have you?"
Well, he wants to demands Barbara's cardigan. She goes,
"You might have asked. That's a good cardigan."
That's a good cardigan.
If you might have asked, that's a good cardigan isn't one of the classic lines from Doctor Who. I don't know what is.
And then Ian goes, "Well, may I?" And she goes, "Oh, well, I suppose so."
I mean, if it's only going, our if it's going to save our lives.
"Oh, well, if you must. First you whisk us off into time and space, leaving all our friends and family behind, and now this."
Now the cardigan.
He's never going to hear the end of it.
I think I know Ian's plan, isn't it? It's, "Well, we've run out of cardigan now, so next the blouse, please."
"Vicky, your petticoat." The other clothes-related amusement is where the Doctor quizzes Ian about how many buttons he had on his jacket. And Ian goes, "Well, I've just seen myself mummified in an exhibition. I wasn't really paying attention to how many buttons there were on my jacket." And the Doctor goes, "Yes, I suppose so."
They're all so playfully sarcastic in each other in the stories, definitely. You know, there are some dodgy lines, like particularly when the Xerons first turn up, there's a lot of rather over-the-top expository dialogue.
Yeah.
So they say things like, I mean, they all have guns and we're unarmed, and everyone knows this is a museum. Yeah, everyone knows it's a museum because it has the words The Space Museum on the titles at the beginning. Even when the Doctor's going, I think it might be some kind of museum. No shit, Sherlock.
Some sort of a space museum.
But then you have lines like... No arms have fallen into zero hands, which you can ridicule, but it's absolutely written there as a joke. And I don't know whether it's Glenn McCoy or whether it's Dennis Spooner having a bit of fun, but it's a comedy serial, and it's got intentionally funny lines in it, like that. So I wasn't quite sold on some of the time travel dialogue, though, and the one other piece of sciencey dialogue I didn't like is when the Doctor finds a rock and says something like, I've never seen such an advanced state of erosion. Like, you can't have an advanced state of erosion is just more erosion. Once it's super advanced, your thing has just eroded away.
Maybe that's what it means. So maybe it means that the planet's surface is incredibly eroded.
He does appear to look at a rock and go, this rock is quite eroded. I've never seen such an eroded rock. And yes, Doctor, you have, it's dust.
It's like sand, yeah. If that's the worst thing about the story.
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, when we talked about the crew all being together and they go off their separate ways, and they remark on, you know, how even though they've all gone their four separate ways, fate has kind of determined they're still going to head towards this conclusion. And Barbara goes off and has her rather dodgy plot-wise in that she's exposed to this paralysing gas. And I think it's at the cliffhanger of episode 3, she's been knocked out by the paralysing gas. And then in episode 4, she just wakes up and gets up.
Yeah, that
while the gas is still coming
really
in.
Really work, does it?
It's rather cheeky, get out.
But they ought to have had them, because it doesn't really matter by that point. They should have just had the gas having been switched off.
Yeah.
But Moroks have been distracted by the rebellion and things like that. So they haven't really gone
the off-screen destruction of the barracks.
Yeah.
And then you've got Ian's plot, which I like because normally, you know, he basically gets a gun from the museum, which is quite cunning. But being nice old Doctor Who, where we don't just charge around with guns, Ian charges around with the gun that everybody knows doesn't work.
Yeah.
But that was all the viewer knows doesn't work.
Music to bluff them or something like that.
Yeah, and so he walks around all the way through waving his gun around and having great fun being threatening with it, but all the time the viewer knows that it isn't a gun that actually works.
Although we did notice that the Doctor brains Darko at one point in a kind of suggesting he hasn't quite overcome his habit of bashing people over the head with rocks in this incarnation.
Up until the point where they had this idea that they'd actually been kind of embalmed in the museum.
It's a really horrible idea, isn't it, being embalmed alive?
And the Doctor has this... Doctor's talking about how he was aware of everything that was happening, which is quite horrible. I quite liked the idea that, as they were unsure about their fate, that what would be really nice is, rather than changing history, they actually ended up in the museum, but because of what they'd done in provoking the rebellion, they were then rescued by the Xerons. And that can't happen because they can't be embalmed because it would kill them, according to the Moroks. But you kind of almost get that. They don't quite get to the point where they're in the museum for real, but they do say their achievement in the story, the way they get out, isn't that they managed to do something different in the museum. It's that they've incited the Xeron rebellion, freed the Xeron slaves, and by helping the Xerons, they've managed to free themselves from the doomed future.
Well, Vicky incites rebellion, but the TARDIS crew kind of inspire the people around them to change their world for the better. And I think,
and the side effect is they save themselves, even though they don't do it directly.
And I think that's what Russell T. Davies' whole characterisation of the Doctor hinges on, ultimately, isn't it? Mm. It's particularly the Ninth Doctor. He doesn't really go and save the day himself most of the time. He acts as a kind of inspiration to others to go and do something better, like Pete or Jabe or
Gwyneth,
even Rose, I suppose, in the Parting of the Ways.
Harry Jones.
All of those people go and do something because they've been inspired by the Doctor. He's made them kind of better people and made them take charge of their own lives.
Mm.
I think, you know, that's really evident in the Space Museum.
It's quite similar to the Thals, isn't it? He kind of says to the Thals, you've got to stand up to the Daleks. It's not, although he helps them do it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's that kind of stand up for yourself. In the Harkonnen, it's stand up for yourself. In the Ninth Doctor Zero, it's more be a better person, isn't it? Make a difference more than violent uprising.
Yeah.
So yeah, the Space Museum it was really nice to see a story I hadn't seen before. Yeah, it's like getting a new piece of Doctor Who when you haven't. And it was actually really fun, for all that I was expecting it to be a bit dreary. It was a jolly, Jape. And although it's a bit slow in places, I'd happily watch it again at some point.
It's rare, because I always think, you know, 60s Doctor Who always feels a lot longer than four episodes, and quite a lot of the surviving Hartnells, I suppose, are more than four episodes. But it was a kind of nice, contained story. It's not, it's by no means the best Hartnell story, and it's by no means the best, you know, Alien Planet Rebellion story, but I think it's good fun. I enjoyed it quite a lot, and I have been unfairly ignoring it for a long time. I think that's definitely one that I would stick on in the future and watch for fun.
And you can see how it fit in nicely between the seriousness of the Crusade and that exciting cliffhanger of the Dalek action adventure, The Chase.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because with Dennis Spooner taking over from David Whittaker, they actually veer much more into comedy, because they've had the kind of Romans. That's clearly a comedy. The Space Museum's a comedy.
The Time Medal is a comedy.
But The Chase is also the most overtly comedic Dalek story I think there's ever been. So,
just ask Morton Dill. Right, well, that's season two done. Our first Hartnell. Still two left in the pot. Let's ask the randomizer which season we should taste next. Okay, randomizer, do your worst. And there we have the decision of the randomizer.
Its decision, as always, is final.
It is, and once again, already done. Way, way, way up to the other end.
Woohoo.
Past the untouched Fifth Doctor's era. And finally, our first Tenth Doctor season.
Okay.
Which is 32. Which means, because we kind of arbitrarily assigned these years, 32 is the specials. So that is, it says including the Next Doctor. So yeah, it's the Next Doctor, Planet of the Dead, Waters of Mars, and the End of Time Parts 1 and 2.
Okay.
That is it, isn't it?
Yes.
Right, well, that's actually quite a small bunch to choose from.
Select bunch, yes.
The Next Doctor, Planet of the Dead, The Waters of Mars, and The End of Time. You go first.
It's hard, isn't it? Because I think it's not. I can't say I think it's Russell and the Tenth Doctor's finest run of episodes, to be honest, but The End of Time is obviously noteworthy for bringing back the Time Lords and hopefully killing them off for good. Waters of Mars, kind of quite scary and creepy. A nice alien planet. Planet of the Dead. Easter special. Meh. I'm struggling to.
It's tricky, isn't it? Because they're not a coherent era. They're not a coherent group. And so it's not like we can say which one is representative of this particular era of Doctor Who, because it's kind of a smattering of different things. One's a Christmas special, one's his finale, one is Russell and David's finale.
Yeah.
One's the Easter special, one's the watery one on Mars. And there's only four. None of them. The End of Time is the most probably interesting, exciting one story-wise, but it is also a two-parter. Although it's no longer than the Space Museum, I suppose. Then I actually really like The Next Doctor, but it is a Christmas story. I'm not particularly in the mood to watch a Christmas story. Although we can see quite how much the Cyber Shades are like the monsters in Attack the Block. And I saw Dervla Kerwin in a play the other week, so that one, I could watch her. Planet of the Dead I've only seen once, I think, and it is the one that sets up the He Will Knock Four Times thing, isn't it? And yeah. I'd be interested to give it another go, just because I remember so little about it, and I wonder if it deserves a reappraising. I haven't seen The Waters of Mars again either, and I'd kind of be interested.
It's probably my favourite one of them. It's my favourite one for most of its length.
Well, this is tricky, isn't it?
It's strange, because at the time, I think I enjoyed them all when they were on, but it's not a run that I can muster a huge amount of enthusiasm for, because it's got that kind of end of an era feel, and it's all, everything's kind of leading up to that. The 10th Doctor dying is almost season 18-ish, isn't it?
The End of Time is, I really liked, when I watched it, its kind of set-piece moments, but I didn't really like the overall story of it. I seem to remember, I didn't really like The Waters of Mars, I didn't really like Planet of the Dead. And I did like The Next Doctor, but it's a bit too Christmassy for the height of summer. I would say The End of Time's tempting, because I haven't seen it for so long, but I'm kind of tempted to say kind of such a category on its own as a big finale that it couldn't begin to be representative of the...
I don't think any of them... I think you're right that none of them are representative. It's a series of specials, so... But if it's special, it's representative.
Yeah.
So in that sense, it's as representative as any of them.
It's the one I can... It's the one I know off the top of my head most clearly what happens in it. I think I must have seen it most. I think I've seen it twice, probably. Maybe three times. I'm tempted to say either Planet of the Dead or Waters of Mars, though, because I think they're both interesting to look at again in retrospect, because I didn't really revisit them at the time.
Uh-huh.
God, we really don't muster much enthusiasm for this lot at all, do we?
It's hard, because it's not that I dislike any of them. I'm finding it hard to think of any huge reason why I'd want to rewatch them again.
Quite a few people from Planet of the Dead have turned up in stuff since.
I don't know how you're going to do this. I just can't think of anything to say about any of them.
I'll tell you what, we'll toss a coin.
Okay.
If the randomizer can be young and vigorous, then so can I. Okay, I've got two coins.
Yep.
If the first coin's...
Is it a one groszit piece?
It's a one. I've got two one-pence pieces. And I know the whole point of doing this podcast was really focused on this discussion part, but I just can't. we've ended up focusing much more on talking about the stories we watched, understandably, and much less on just wittering about
what we might watch,
which one we might watch, and which ones we've seen recently, and which ones are too long. So, given that, let's completely boil it down. We've got nothing to choose between them, really. So, I've got two coins. The first one will determine whether it's the first one or two, or the second one. One or two. So if it's heads,
yeah,
then it's either The Next Doctor or
Planet of the Dead.
If it's tails, it's Waters of Mars and the End of Time.
Okay.
Second coin will then choose first or second again. Heads first, tails second. Right. I can't flick a coin to save my life, so I'm going to chuck this vaguely up. You flip that coin.
Heads.
So it's either The Next Doctor or Planet of the Dead, and the second coin could have just used the same coin twice, of course, but.
Heads.
It's The Next Doctor. Should we not watch that? Should we watch one of the
other
ones?
Let's watch Planet of the Dead.
See, we can take a decision after all. Planet of the Dead, listeners, will be our choice from this artificially created season of Doctor Who that we have called number 32. Tune in next time to find out what we thought about that and to see where the randomizer takes us next. Bye-bye.
Bye.
I'm just going to put after the end credits, I'm just going to have you going, fuck off.